From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Across the country, students are gearing up for, or maybe trying not to think about, the first day of school. Pencils, backpacks, lunchboxes. For some, all that's missing is teachers. It's not a national crisis, but around the country, schools and districts are struggling to meet the demand for teachers. In Arizona, California, Kansas, Oklahoma, and more, vacancies vary by subject, by state, and they have administrators scrambling, sometimes changing the rules. This hour on Point, a look at teacher shortages across the country as we head toward the new school year. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is your city, town, region grappling with a teacher shortage? Why? And what's the answer? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With us first today from Washington is Ross Brenneman, assistant editor at Education Week. Ross, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So the headline looks like a national teacher crisis, but then you begin to poke in there, and it's not really. Some places it's hard to get a job as a teacher, and others are just crying out, even with school just a few days away now. What creates this patchwork of some with teachers aplenty and some other areas with serious shortages?
Right. So I think a good baseline to start is understanding that the teaching profession isn't just one giant pool that states can siphon from as they want to. It's, you know, the teachers aren't running backs in the NFL that you can pick off a waiver wire or draft.
Trade from
or
city to city, yep.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, each state has its own licensure requirements and certification processes and working conditions. And so and not just between states, but within states, too. Districts can vary wildly, and in districts, schools can be entirely differently run. And so effectively, we have not so much a national education system as at minimum 51 education systems. And it can create a lot of nuance and difficulty to figure out what's going on.
So when they talk about labor mobility, teaching may not be at the top of that list. That leaves the question in front of us of why some places have serious shortages and others do not. I mean, I'm looking here, New York Times just this week, mm-hmm. talking about Louisville, Kentucky, about Nashville, about Oklahoma City, about Providence, Rhode Island, for very local shortages. Mm-hmm. And then whole states, Kansas, Arizona, California. What is the range of circumstances that creates a regional or local shortage?
So it's any number of things. In some places, there are some signs that would point to the economy. You know, they're in California, for instance, that's commonly talked about. And just a few years ago, California was actually laying off thousands of teachers. And
in the recession.
During the recession, you're correct. Although some of those layoffs started beforehand, but whereas in Kansas, a lot of teachers would point to working conditions. The state cut several million dollars from the budget and have changed some licensure requirements, and there's a lot of unhappiness within the teaching profession there. You actually have
Kansas is in
districts.
The middle of major budget cuts right across the board, but including education, with implications, I guess.
Correct. Yeah, to the point where now you have I talked to someone in – or I read someone in Independence, Missouri, which is right next to Kansas, mm-hmm. is openly poaching teachers from Kansas, saying, hey, we have better working conditions. Come work for us. And it's the same way, you know, North Carolina lost a lot of teachers for similar reasons, because North Carolina – has a very low per pupil spending for education, and that includes teacher salaries, and so teachers eventually will go elsewhere.
So if you don't pay enough, now there were layoffs during the recession, how deeply could states lay teachers off and still keep everything going here? What kind of percentage layoffs did we see?
Well, it varies from place to place. Some places were buffered a little bit by race-to-the-top spending, and investments. Some places increased class size, but that's hugely contentious. No one wants their children's class sizes to go up. But theoretically, all those teachers that laid off, I mean, they weren't all at the end of their careers ready to retire anyway. They're still out there somewhere or mobile, or maybe they chose other professions. So when we talk about shortages, sometimes it's just figuring out how to draw some of those teachers that were laid off back if they trust the system enough to come back.
Is this about teacher pay generally here? I mean, I'm looking at starting salaries for teachers around the country. You go down the list, you know, Alabama is $36,000 average starting salary. Alaska, where everything's higher, is $44,000. Arkansas, $32,000. Arizona, $31,000. California, $41,000. I mean, you can go right on down. Idaho, $31,000. Iowa, $33,000. I don't know. Massachusetts, $40,600. Mm-hmm. Texas, $38,000. Is that a bad starting salary for people coming out of university these days? Is it decent? Is it an issue?
Salary is definitely part of the issue, and there was a report released a few months ago, I think from the National Center for Teaching Quality, that showed that teacher pay increases year to year don't go up nearly fast enough. Some districts have taken steps to change that. D.C. is probably one of the most well-known ones, with huge teacher bonuses based on performance.
$51,000 in District of Columbia. That looks to me like the highest in the country. So they've worked.
It's definitely one of the. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, not at all. But I just wondered if that makes teaching, just in terms of pay, look good, bad, or average for new graduates.
Well, it's certainly not, you know, the same that you're going to be getting if you're, you know, if you're graduating college with a degree in a science field, and you're deciding between pursuing a master's in education or going to work for, you know, a big startup in San Francisco and Silicon Valley. You know, teaching's not going to compete anywhere with that, probably. But salary is not the only issue. For a lot of teachers, it's the working conditions aside from salary. It's the in-school atmosphere, how supported they feel by their principal, how good their mentors are. Mentors play a huge role, according to a number of studies, in retaining teachers. And not all schools have great mentorship programs. There's collegiality. There's the students themselves and the parents and the community support. It's all these kinds of things. And when they're all you know, out of whack or all negative, that can really hurt retention.
Ross, what happens when you've got school starting in a week or two and you've got a class that has no teacher for it yet? What do people do?
Sure. So one process is long-term subs. There's a process in many places, emergency certification, where teachers, not necessarily with training, are allowed to take stewardship of a class. Just because the school year started doesn't mean districts aren't still searching for teachers to fill those vacancies. Sometimes where places allow class size increases, you might see some condensing of classes. Those are probably two of the most common things, long-term subs. But even the long-term sub market is also not necessarily thriving in some places.
Days to go, still looking for teachers. Back in June in Charlotte, North Carolina, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools there, CNN reported they had resorted to posting ads on Craigslist for teachers, and some people didn't know what to make of the district using Craigslist as a teacher recruiting tool. Hear from CNN.
It's generally craft services, and teacher is not a craft service.
Craigslist is a good place to look for jobs, but it feels a little like it cheapens it.
But if you're beating the bushes for teachers and time is growing short, you'll go where you need to go. Ross Brenneman, please stand by in Washington. With us right now as well from Pasadena, California, is Paul Bruno. He's an advisor for Deans for Impact. It's a national organization of leading colleges of education and other programs that aim at improving student learning. Paul Bruno, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what's going on in the schools themselves, teaching schools? Are they enrolling enough people into the study of education and teaching for us to have an output that will satisfy the country's need?
So as you guys were discussing, it really varies a lot from place to place. So I'm in California, for example, and I've seen, you know, in California, we've seen some of the steepest drops in teacher preparation enrollment, as much as 75% from the peak about a decade ago. And that has really resulted in far fewer teachers being certified.
Wait, explain what you mean by that teacher preparation. So you're saying that the teachers' colleges or courses of study have seen a 75% drop in enrollment?
So in California, that's the case.
Wow.
Where it's been, yes, it's a very substantial drop. And so the drop in new teachers being certified each year has been about half, actually, since the peak. And that's actually after 10 consecutive years of decline in California. And that's unusually steep.
What can account for such a giant fall off? Is everybody going to work in Silicon Valley? They're all working for Google? Or what's happening?
Economics are certainly a part of it. In California, as was discussed a little bit before, California, even when the economy was not in technically in a recession, there were definitely issues with school budgets being hit hard. And so pink slips, which were basically warnings to teachers that they couldn't be guaranteed a job in the next year, were going out even before the recession. And actually, when I started teaching 6 years ago, I started teaching middle school science, we were actually in the opposite situation where we weren't having a teacher shortage. Teachers were being warned that they could be laid off each year.
And so people will do what they have to do. Once they leave, do they come back or do they tend to go? If they leave because they fear a layoff, when their openings again, do they tend to line up and take those jobs or they're gone?
It's a little early to tell at this point because California has only just started picking up its hiring again over the last couple of years. It's not obvious how many are going to come back and how many are gone for good.
Nationally, the drop in enrollment in teacher preparation programs almost 30% from 2010 to 2014. And you can see that if they're not coming in, the pipeline is not going to produce them at the other end. Just a month before the opening of classes, Charlotte, North Carolina, one example, New York Times reports desperately trying to fill 200 vacancies. It's not coast to coast, but many, many places around the country. Serious teacher shortages. Louisville, Nashville, Oklahoma City, Providence, Rhode Island, Kansas, California, Arizona. We're talking big zones of need here, and we're looking at why. Paul Bruno, please stand by in Pasadena, California. Ross Brenneman at Education Week Teacher. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about teacher shortages around the country, where they are, why they are, who's well covered, who's desperate to hire, and in what fields, what subjects. Ross Brenneman is with us from Education Week Teacher, joins us from Washington, from Pasadena, California, where they're having big issues in California. Paul Bruno is with us. He's with Deans for Impact, organization that looks at teacher preparation and the pipeline, you might say here. Different school districts, some of them lowering their standards, changing their requirements, looking to new and different alternative pools of teachers, even just for the short term to cover. Here's an interview with Indiana News Station WISH-TV, August 3rd. Indiana State Teachers Association President Teresa Meredith talking about the teacher shortage there, what she hopes to see in the future.
I want a system in place that supports the profession, that encourages people to come into the profession, not these alternative pathways, not come teach for a while, but actually be here as a professional and want to do this work long term.
Paul Bruno in California, Ross Brenneman in Washington, please stand by. Mary Kerner joins us right now from Phoenix, Arizona. She's dean of the Teachers College at Arizona State University. Arizona in the middle of serious problems right now with the supply of teachers. Mary Kerner, Dean Kerner, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
What's created your crunch here, your shortage of teachers in Arizona?
Well, I think this has to be looked at historically. It always bothers me that it's right now we discovered that people don't want to go into teaching. And really, if you may remember, or other people may remember, when we were in elementary school and public school, teaching was a noble, quote-unquote, profession because the best and the brightest women occupied it. Mm-hmm. And then we had the feminist movement, which, of course, was great, but it gave these best and brightest women choices, and they began to leave to go to other professions. Mm-hmm. And we had no actual legitimate response to that except to say, well, if you want to avoid the draft, go into teaching. Or if you want to be a day-to-day sub,
during
go into
Vietnam
teaching.
War. Mm-hmm.
Okay, mm-hmm. And during the Vietnam War. And those teachers who were underprepared and often not good, some good, mm-hmm. My husband was one of them, actually stayed in teaching a long time. And those problems with unprofessional or deprofessionalization of teaching teaching have persisted. And that's what's going to happen again. As we open the gates with no scrutiny of who's teaching, teachers who are underprepared may not be actually good to be with children, are going to be in classrooms. And then there's a leadership issue as well. Principals leave at a revolving door. So we have to look systematically at the whole system. In our college, our enrollment did drop during the bad economy. We're a very large college. We're one of the largest, if not the largest, in the country.
How many do you enroll, Dean Kerner?
We have, in our entire college, over 5,000 students. In teacher preparation, almost 3,000.
Okay.
We graduate over 1,000 teachers a year. We're a research level one institution. It's unusual that a research level one also has a strong teacher prep program. And that's another issue about colleges of education. So we do research, but really importantly, we put teachers in our community. And
can we turn back for just a second, Dean Kerner, because you came in loaded for bear there. I wasn't quite prepared for all that, but it's so that's quite an opening salvo, Dean Kerner. So the first thing
I've been thinking about it a long time.
We noticed. I like it. Right out of the gate, you say that you talk about this notion that people don't want to go into teaching. I actually wasn't coming to it with that presumption. I thought maybe it was pay, or maybe there was a mismatch of, people in a region. Do you? But you see who's coming to the door to knock and say, "I want to prepare to be a teacher." Do you see a fall off in interest in teaching?
Oh, absolutely. Because it's not, when you hear about Finland and all these other countries, those the people have high status when they're teachers. Here, pick up the paper, it's a criticism about what teachers aren't doing. We want to take away their benefits. We want to take their retirement. We want to give them low pay, and we want them to be the best and the brightest for our children. Now, many school districts, as you were saying, not only in the country, but even in LA, in California, have no trouble attracting top-notch teachers. But what happens is that many of the teachers who are underprepared end up in districts that have children of high poverty, children who have second language, who have are dealing with second language, and we seem to not care that much. This isn't a problem created last month. It isn't a problem created in the next couple of weeks.
You mean just throw them in there and the teacher will sink or swim, be successful or not, and we don't care.
And hey, you know what? That's the way it goes. And so I think what we have to do is really look at the teaching profession, raise the status of teaching. Arizona State University has many students who are first-generation college. Teaching is always an entree to middle class. They want to enter middle class. They want to be lifelong teachers. Our students will break your heart with what they've done to get to be teachers.
I believe
and they're
it.
Excellent in a classroom. And we have a very, very rigorous program. When our enrollment dropped, we made our program more rigorous, kind of seemingly contradictory, but not really. So we're attracting the best students. That's a systematic issue. We're working with high schools to recruit students. It's a pipeline issue.
To recruit teaching students. Let me ask you this. You also threw this one out, that people are open. I think I'm quoting you here, opening the gates with no scrutiny of who's teaching. What do you mean by that? That sounds frightening.
Well, if you're hiring a day-to-day sub, what's the scrutiny in someone signing up to be a day-to-day sub?
I really don't know, but I've always presumed that there was some.
Well, I think now they have to have fingerprint check in order to make sure they're not felons.
That seems like a pretty minimal bar.
Yes, it does. It does seem like a minimal
bar. Welcome to school. The teacher's
it?
Not a felon. Oh, great.
And so I think, traditionally what people say is that, well, I've taught. What's the big deal? They haven't taught 30 kids in a classroom, in any classroom. And so we think that because I've taught, I've tutored my kid, I've tutored a younger sibling. Well, this how hard could this be? And what we ignore is that there really needs to be preparation for teaching, not just content areas. Sometimes I understand the whole math science thing, but every teacher needs to know math and science, not just people who are going to teach math. Elementary school teachers, we increase the rigor for second grade teachers in math. So it's not just content. How many times have you been in the classroom of a university professor who knows a lot of content, but it's torture? They don't understand how to teach.
Math, science, special ed, those seem to be the areas that have the most trouble attracting who they need. Mary Kerner deals with it in Arizona, where they have seen teachers, I'm quoting here from the Washington Post, leaving in droves, and they've got a serious teacher shortage. Dean Kerner, please stand by. Ross Brennerman, Paul Bruno, Derek's calling from New Orleans. Derek, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to ask your experts if they thought that the villainization of teachers' unions that's been going on lately, and by implication, teachers, plays a part in this.
That's an interesting question. Dean Kerner, I'll bring that to you, but Paul, may I come first to you? Teaching education has become a very, very politicized issue in this country, not to say polarized. Sometimes teachers have taken the brunt of that. Unions, certainly. Is that part of what may have changed the atmosphere, Paul?
It's certainly a possibility, but the evidence for that is not at all clear at this point. So if you survey teachers today, they still report extremely high levels of job satisfaction, for example. They do also report that they feel an increasing amount of pressure for accountability reasons. So it's entirely possible that that is affecting teacher morale and the appeal of the job to prospective teachers. But again, teachers do still report being very happy with their work. So we don't have great evidence on exactly how much those things matter. And it's also worth noting that in California has actually been somewhat less politicized and somewhat less polarized and somewhat less aggressive on accountability than other states, but has nevertheless still seen very substantial drops, much larger than in some states where it's been much more contentious around teachers and their politics.
Dean Kerner, I think I did hear you sort of pointing to villainization as the word Derek uses,
yes.
But that did seem to be part of what you were describing.
Yes, well, I think that what he's talking about is, let's take the union piece out. Arizona doesn't have unions, actually. But if you take that out, what unions did was represent benefits, collective bargaining, ensuring pensions. And also, class size was often attached to working environments. So if you took the union, you know, mediation out of it, I think all teachers still want those things. And I think there was always a trade-off. So my husband taught for 34 years. Mm-hmm. At the end of it, he would get a pension. He would settle for very average salaries, and that's okay.
He could anticipate
to
a steady income,
$150,000 salary. However, now what we're seeing is that those things that unions advocated for, we're now saying are too much. So why would someone go into a profession where there is no guarantee of salary, no guarantee of benefits, no guarantee? These are people who have who have families, who have children, who have a future. And so I think that recruiting people into
a profession. Do you have tenure, Dean Kerner?
I do have tenure. I do have tenure.
Yeah, there's an outspoken tenure-holding dean, a professor right there. Stand by. Ellen in Coral Springs, Florida. Ellen, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi, Tom. I just want to say I am a former teacher. I retired last year at 61, and it broke my heart to do it. I loved my job. I would have done it for free. That's what I told everyone.
We love hearing that, though. We don't want to ask that of you, Ellen. So why'd you retire?
No. I retired because what has happened to teaching. I taught second grade. I also taught art,
okay,
which is my love. And what they did was, to save money, they gave me double classes, 10 classes a day, no breaks. Whoa. Except a half an hour for lunch. The conditions were so bad, I would have 30 kindergartners in a room that I was supposed to teach. And that's dangerous. Besides, you should have seen when we had a fire drill. It was insane. That being said, I couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah.
And honestly, it broke my heart to retire. And anybody who says they want to become a teacher, I'll say, think really hard if you want to do this job, because if you can do anything else, do it. Because
Ouch.
They make it so, so unpleasant.
Ellen, in Coral Springs, that is hardly an advertisement to get into the field, and we hear it loud and clear. It's painful to hear that from somebody who audibly loved it. I mean, Ross Brenneman, is that what's going on here? That it's just, you know, with budget cutbacks and all the rest, it's not fun enough. If a young person hears Ellen's testimony there, why would they want to jump in?
Sure. It would be disingenuous to say that working conditions don't play a huge role, or at least, you know, a significant role in retention.
10 classes a day, 30-minute break in the
it's
whole day.
Lot.
That's unbelievable. 30 kids in a kindergarten class?
And she's saying a lot that I've heard from a lot of other teachers. There's something that a short clip from a New York Times article that I think is worth reading. It says, a survey found that only 1/4 of teachers would wholeheartedly recommend teaching to a young person making a decision about a career. slightly more than half said they would make the recommendation with major reservations, and 22% say they would flatly advise against becoming a teacher. That was an article from 1985 in the New York Times. So this is something that's been plaguing the profession for a while. It's just possibly...
Boy, it's a long way from that kind of inspiring view of get in there and educate the next generation and be uplifted every day by your interaction. I mean, that must be hard for you to hear, Mary. You're looking to enroll people at Arizona State, and you hear a teacher like Ellen saying, don't go in there.
Well, I'm an advocate for teachers, obviously, right?
Yes.
And I think that that's kind of what's missing also in the conversation, is that teaching is a great profession. And it's not rainbows and little apples dancing mm-hmm. around. It's a hard profession. Mm-hmm. But I think what your caller said is not uncommon, that it is a way to have an impact on people's lives, families. I mean, you know, there's polls that say individual parents love their kids' teachers. So it's a great profession. So that makes it even more tragic that a great profession that is accessible to people, that you can get a job, that it still is not valued by local communities, by state communities, and nationally.
And we're not talking just communities, but we're talking those who fund education. I mean, you're there in a position of prominence in Arizona. Mm-hmm. Here you've got the Washington Post talking about teachers leaving Arizona in droves. You've got your Arizona Department of Education with this report out last year saying that if teachers keep leaving, quote, students will not meet their full potential, and, quote, Arizona will not be able to ensure economic prosperity for its citizens and create the workforce of tomorrow. When the leaders of your state read that, does it not prompt them to action? That sounds pretty dire. You've got the lowest spending per student nearly the lowest in the country. Doesn't it make them want to turn it around, get going? That sounds like an emergency.
Well, I can't speak for the leaders of the state.
You're the dean of the Teachers College at Arizona State University.
Right. What I can do is speak for the College of Education, which is that all of our students are hired, over 90%, and they're better prepared to be teachers, and we have data that shows they stay considerably longer in high-poverty schools. And that's by intention. That's because that's how we prepare. That's how we recruit people. That's how we support them and keep them in classrooms. I think in many districts are saying it's true. Our teachers, our graduates deserve to have more money, and they're being paid more money. They're being given bonuses. So that's what I can do, and that is a big task to be able to do. But I think that the response from leadership in every state, Arizona included, is mixed. I think some of it is wishful thinking that money doesn't matter in education. It would be the only area where money doesn't matter. I mean, you know. And so, I mean, you can tell me, other people can tell me, how did that happen? How did that magical thinking start about education and about schools?
I don't have the answer to that. You mean that you can just take resources away and it will work anyway? Surely part of
exactly.
that came from the
yeah.
idea that there would be teachers standing there who would continue to do it, because once you see all those little faces staring up at you, you feel pretty bad if you're not teaching them, if you're the teacher.
Yeah, and I've been told that. I've had donors say to me, well, you know, if you love children, salary doesn't matter. Well, that doesn't actually make much sense unless you can go to the local grocery store and pay in devotion. I mean, you know. So I think there's a lot of dreaming going on there.
Dean Mary Kerner at the Teachers College at Arizona State University, please stand by in Phoenix. Ross Brenneman at Education Week Teacher in Washington. Paul Bruno with Deans for Impact in Pasadena, California. Thank you very much for joining us for a minute today, Paul. Much appreciated.
My pleasure.
We are talking about teacher shortages around the country, looking at where they are and why they are, who's well covered, who's desperate to hire just days before the new school year, and in what fields, what subjects. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
This podcast is sponsored by Casper. Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support by combining premium latex foam and memory foam. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. Pick the one that is best for you and try it out, risk-free for 100 days, with free delivery and returns. go to casper.com/onpoint and you can save $50. That's casper.com/onpoint. Now back to the show.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about teacher shortages around the country, not coast to coast, but in many spots across the country. New York Times calling out this week Louisville, Kentucky, Nashville, Oklahoma City, Providence, Rhode Island, and whole states where it's a big issue. California, Kansas, Arizona. Mary Kerner is with us. She's dean of the Teachers College at Arizona State University. With us today from Phoenix, Ross Brenneman is here from Education Week Teacher. Ross, I wish you'd take us a little more into what creates these pockets of shortage. I mean, when I look at this list, Nashville's kind of a happening town. Oklahoma City, Providence, Rhode Island, Louisville, Kentucky. These are not Siberia. Why would there be shortages in locales such as these?
So one thing that's, I think, going on here is that, you know, when you think about why you want to become a teacher, you in the general sense, a lot of students want to become teachers because they were inspired by a teacher and they want to give back to their community. And their community is not necessarily in Nashville. It's sometimes in rural South Dakota or rural Oklahoma.
But is there that little mobility? People can't say, well, I eventually want to teach in Nashville or
there's
Louisville?
There's definitely mobility. Some of that's hard to track. There was a landmark longitudinal study that came out a few months ago that looked at teacher retention and turnover and transitions over a five-year period. And it turned out that retention for new teachers was much better than had been previously acknowledged or thought of. You've probably heard the stat, 50% of new teachers leave within the first 5 years. And this study said, well, no, it's actually more like 17%. And so it's, you know, even with all these data systems, it's still kind of hard to track turnover and movement within the teaching profession.
Dean Kerner, when you look at the map of the country and where the shortages are, where the most acute need is, and you look at your graduating students, first of all, they're coming out of Arizona State. So are they only qualified to teach in Arizona? If they have national mobility, where would you point them?
I think you've put your finger on a problem, and that is we don't have a centralized system in the United States. And so if you're certified in Arizona, there may or may not be reciprocity with states like California. In California, mm-hmm. there isn't reciprocity. So you're actually being certified in the area where you are living in a sub-certificate or in a regular certificate. So part of that decentralization is the cost of people actually not being able to move that easily from state to state. And I also think that conditions are different in different places. And so even if you probably looked more at each specific place where there are shortages. For example, we have the most isolated school district in the country, the Havasupai Reservation in the bottom of the Grand Canyon. It's a federal school, but nonetheless, no surprise, hard to get teachers there. And so often what we should be doing and colleges of education should be doing is growing people in those communities by having remote, their on-site teacher preparation in order to prepare them because they will stay in that community and they benefit that community. So this has to be a comprehensive view. We tend to have a knee-jerk reaction in education. We're going to solve this problem this fall. But if we think ahead, if we think 5 and 10 years ahead, growing your own in communities, wherever that is, starting in high school, building a pipeline of people who want to be teachers and supporting them.
You've got to be ready to support them. Indeed, Charlie writes to us online here, Indiana's beginning teaching salary is around $33,500. A family member of hers makes about $50,000, the average, but she's been teaching for at least 20 years, she writes online here. So are we asking, our listener writes, 20 and 30-year-olds to wait two decades to make an income high enough to be able to afford houses, cars, children, and college for their children? Question mark? Big question mark? Nancy in Portland, Maine. Nancy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've been a teacher for 20 years, and I think one of the things that I see changing is the pressure and culture of teaching has become so much more difficult than it was when I started teaching.
The pressure and culture, what's the problem or the pressure?
So I think as far as like national pressure, government pressure, administrative pressure. There's so many assessments that need to be done. We have more children with varying needs in our classroom with no money or support to meet all those needs, but yet we're expected to do that. Larger classrooms, less funds, and then we get vilified in the press when we don't do, you know, we seem to be the people that get blamed for so many things that happen, but yet the expectations keep going higher.
That would create a pressure. I can definitely see that, and we all know the elements of that. I appreciate your call, Nancy. One more from Nashville, one of the cities that cited here as having a teacher shortage. Kathleen, you're on the air. Kathleen, what can you tell us about why?
Well, you asked why, and I think the reason is in Nashville and what I see around the South is, and I've been educated up north, mm-hmm. I have a northern education, okay. And I moved to the South with my daughter. So
okay.
I received a southern education via my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And what I realized is in 1962, there was a decision called Brown versus Board of Ed, and this horrible thing started in Nashville. Everybody took their kids out of public school. Not everybody, just the top 10%. Everybody out of the rich white neighborhoods moved their kids out, okay?
Okay.
And what we got left is everybody who's working hard and with very little resources. Parents of two income families barely able to make the rent. Barely able to do it. So they're not working at the PTA as hard and as much as I could name a few of the private schools, but...
Mm-hmm. You're talking parents of children enrolled in the schools with less time to contribute to the school community.
Exactly. And less time to argue with the Board of Ed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
To advocate for their kids, for their education, for their teachers.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So there's no... The money is going to the private school. The money of Nashville is over in a private school. And what's left over are, and those are the people also writing a check. The governor's children don't go to a private school. I mean, don't go to public school. The mayor's children didn't go to public school. The mayor now kids don't go to a public school. And so where are we? Who is going to actually get a benefit of having more money in the public education, not someone who's writing a check to those people.
Not the people with the biggest voices. Kathleen, that is really interesting analysis. Dean Kerner, what about it? This was the warning long ago. If you start siphoning money off into the private arena too heavily, you're going to undercut public schools. Is this it? Is the rubber meeting the road? You can't get the teachers in that you want because they don't have the resources, and there goes the spiral.
Well, I think that what is being talked about is that schools reflect all the social problems that we have in our society. Integration, segregation, poverty, discrimination, inequities in terms of salary. Although, you know, paying tuition doesn't necessarily mean there's less money. It means maybe there's less advocacy because schools are paid by individual real estate taxes, which mm-hmm. is another issue. So all those together, you know, kids have to be vaccinated. Kids have to be fed by schools because we can't solve those problems often except through schools. That is true. But if we turn that on its head, we can also say that teachers have opportunities to make impact for all children's lives in schools. And instead of seeing this as a deficit, this is something we have to work against. This makes the working conditions worse. We can also see that there are real opportunities for teachers to make a difference, impact in kids' lives. But it has to be a systematic looking at it. I can't solve poverty, but I can help children learn how to read so that they have potential in life in order to themselves make money. I think if we get ground down too much by all of society's problems and how this is a dump on schools, we begin to lose the view that this is a democracy. We have to have good public schools. We have to have literate population. And for people like me who went to public school, mm-hmm. who was from a working class family,
me too.
they were extremely successful. And we got to go to college, got to go to public mm-hmm. universities. So there are a lot of examples of people like us who have a different life, a richer life, a fuller life, because we had access to more income, access to more education. So that is also the history of the United States.
There's the evangelist speaking. Dean Kerner, and quite necessarily, please stand by there in Phoenix if you'd be good enough.
Sure.
Angela Minichi joins us right now from Washington. She's director of the Center on Great Teachers and Leaders at the American Institutes for Research. Angela Minichi, thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You have looked at how other countries keep their teacher pipeline robust and full. What's done abroad that we might learn from?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of lessons learned from some of the top-performing nations like Singapore, Finland, and South Korea that would be helpful to this conversation. So, for example, we know in those countries they have, you know, much more selective admissions to teacher training. The government actually regulates the supply of teachers to match demand. I think one of the things that your guests have been talking about today is a lack of kind of information about what the teacher supply and demand looks like both nationally at the state level and at the local level. So we know in other high-performing countries that they actually have better information and have policies that address that kind of match between supply and demand. Other things that your guests have been talking about, you know, the cultural respect accorded to teaching. Teaching is thought of as a much higher esteemed profession in other countries, high-performing nations, and then teaching is considered a career. So people go into the teaching profession not to just stay there for a couple of years, but they really think about it as a long-term career. So I think there are some lessons we can learn from other kind of high-performing nations that would actually help us think about how we should address some of these issues here in the United States.
Well, what about their pay? Is it comparable to American pay? Is it very different? Is that a fundamental difference? Or is it not about the money as much as the respect, esteem, standing?
Yeah, you know, some of these countries are very different. So, for example, Singapore actually monitors starting salaries in the market, and they really try to make sure that they can make teaching a very competitive profession. And they do things like have substantial bonuses that they pay out to teachers, not something like $1,000, but something like $20,000 or $30,000 every couple of years to keep people in the profession. But that's not the case in all countries. Again, there are the kinds of benefits I think your guests have been talking about. Teacher pay is important to attract people to the profession, but it doesn't necessarily keep them in the profession. So part of the bigger picture of the conversation that we're having today is that we can't just think about bringing more people into the profession. We've also got to think about keeping them in the profession. That's really key as well.
But when you talk about selective admissions in these high-performing countries, Singapore, South Korea, Finland, to teacher prep institutions, I guess, you can have selective admissions when you have high demand to get into those schools, but you've got to have the high demand in the first place to get in.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that this is also kind of a bigger issue about the changing nature of the teaching profession itself. And so a lot of what we've been doing is kind of watching how the teaching profession has changed in terms of who comes into it, why they stay. But I think right now we're really at a point in the conversation where we need to start thinking about how do we actually drive and shape the teaching profession? So what are the kinds of policies and incentives and practices that we need to get the right people into the profession? How do we adequately prepare them? And then how do we develop support and retain them as well? So I agree with you. It's not just about selective admissions, but it's actually about policies that are thoughtful about where we want the profession to go.
It sounds not necessarily that systematic or that focused on that, what we've got right now. Moral hodgepodge. Jill is calling from Boston, our backyard here. Jill, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been teaching for 19 years. My first three were in public school, and the last 16 has been in an independent school.
Okay.
In my independent school, I feel valued. I work with smart people. My professional development is paid for, both my time and the courses I take.
What does independent school mean in your case, Jill? You mean a private school?
I do. I mean a private school that not everyone can afford. But
okay, so fancy, prep school kind of thing.
Fancy.
Okay.
But I probably don't make as much money as I could in the public schools, but I feel valued as an intellectual person. Teaching is hard. And I was thinking I think it's the dean, the woman in your program who said, where did this magical thinking come that you don't need to earn money if you love mm-hmm. children? Mm-hmm. Teaching is so much more than just loving children.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that comes from women traditionally being in the profession, mm-hmm. and it was just sort of assumed that there would be some sort of feminine nurturing thing that would just take over.
But you're saying, look at the intellectual challenge here.
Oh, my goodness. Intellectual, organizational, social. There are so many skills that are needed, and I have that development and nurturing of that with my colleagues at my school. And I think if you want to retain people, good, smart, creative people, the profession needs to be elevated to that level by everybody, by parents and administrators and politicians. It needs to be valued the same way we value CEOs or any other profession that gets paid and compensated well.
Jill, you've been on both sides of the fence. Is there any reason that we couldn't or can't do that in public schools as well as your glossy private school?
I think, and I don't really know, but it feels to me like politics. It feels like so many people wanting easy answers for really complex schools or complex places. And I think maybe instead of easy answers, just really being willing to get in there and pay attention to what's in front of you. Everyone thinks they know, but I don't know if people really know until they get in there themselves.
Jill, thanks for your call. Ross Brenneman, if you could point a young, soon-to-be graduate toward a part of the country for a good teaching career, where would you point them?
I would say there are certainly great districts in New York City, North Carolina. It kind of depends on what you want to, what kind of environment you want to work with. But one thing that we haven't really talked about is that there's a huge population of teachers of color who are of untapped potentially population of teachers of color. The profession's very white. So it's not just about saying, hey, everyone, you know, generally going. It's helping find, you know, potential teachers of color and saying,
get everybody in the
hey,
pool.
This is a great profession.
Yeah, exactly. Pull the curtain back on the full spectrum of American talent. Ross Brenneman at Education Week Teacher. Angela Minichi at the American Institutes for Research and Dean Mary Kerner at Arizona State. Our thanks to you all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.